Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us for the conversation on this Aloha Friday, October 24th. Today we talk about the dredging of a Big Island boat ramp and harbor. It was going well until it wasn't. What failed and what does the state do now? A red flag fire alert is in place, issued by the National Weather Service. How Kauai is leading the state with new codes for wildfire protection now in place. And a film about Lahaina's story of recovery wins a top prize at the Hawaii International Film Festival. We also hear from a shopper who is facing the rising cost of food at home and at work. And we circle back into Chinatown and downtown as we wind up our look at life in our Honolulu, new businesses sprouting up in little corners in low-rent districts. We also highlight a photography exhibit that captures the heart of Chinatown. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Big Island lawmakers are concerned about the recent collapse of the Pohiki Boat Harbor in the Puna area. It had been inundated with lava back in the 2018 eruption, cutting off a lifeline for commercial fishermen and volcano tour operators. The State Harbors Division of the Land and Natural Resources Department had been hopeful that the dredging project had been ahead of schedule this summer. But recent high ocean swells collapsed the improvements and closed the channel once again. DLNR Chair Don Chang said it, like the community, is terribly disappointed. We talked to Senator Joy San Buenaventura just about an hour ago about the setback in her district.
Well, right before the storm surge filled it in, I spoke to a DLNR engineer, and they were super hopeful because they were monitoring the surge and the current was actually pulling away sand. So they were super hopeful that it would actually stay that the way it was. They did not take into account the storm surge, which filled it back in. So I am super, of course, heartbroken. On the same token, though, hopefully until we could get more monies to dredge it, the community can use that area as a safe swim area until we're able to get it reopened for the fishermen, because we've also lost all of our swimming venues during the 2018 lava flow. But of course, we wanted the fishermen to come back in.
Well, you know, I understand that DLNR was looking at this fix. I mean, they had other options that were more expensive, but they wanted to do something, right? Because
exactly.
This area has been closed for so long.
That's exactly it. We had provided multiple options. The preferred option, which was stated in the town hall, and actually the community came up with it and the engineers backed it up, was a complete dredge, which was a $40 million, which had the highest probability of no return. And then, of course, the second option was that with a dredge and retaining walls, which would have cost about $20 million or so. And $46 million apparently is what the DLNR came up with, which actually costs more than a complete dredge of Pohiki Bay. And of course, the other options were the various channels. I understand, you know, I've been talking to the community really since August 2018, which was when the lava flow ended, and the fishermen came to me, and they, you know, basically they've lost their main avenue of financial support, the cost of driving all the way to Wailoa, as well as the cost of the fuel from Wailoa to get to the fishing grounds around this cape, you know, Kumakahi Cape, was super expensive, and it was cutting into their bottom line, and basically they were running into the red because they couldn't compete with other fishermen simply because of the huge cost of fuel to them, not only the fuel of driving to Wailoa, but also the
time
fuel to get around that cape. You know, it was really the livelihood of the Hawaiian Kalo, and it's a fishing community. It is a community which with long cultural roots that made it a priority for me and my successor, Gregor Ilagan, to open it up for the fishermen. And way back then when the DLNR engineers were talking to me and they said, well, we're not quite sure about the swale and of dredging it up, and this is before the alternatives came up with, they said they would need to test it first. And so basically the request of the fishermen was, let's just open it up, let's test it out, let's see what the current does. And I guess that's what it ended up. And it's a failed test. And we're hoping at the next budget we're able to get more. The reality is if we had waited too long to get the right amount of money, it would have been a forever wait. Because like last year, we had the Maui fire multi-billion-dollar settlement, as well as monies to dredge up to help out the nonprofits who are cut off from federal funds. This year, with the shutdown and the huge costs of federal funds being frozen out of Hawaii, it couldn't have been put in the budget for this year. So at least an effort was made, and hopefully we can cockroach some more money out of the budget this coming session, so we can actually open it up before we put in the retaining walls or the complete dredge, which would have been the most cost-effective, highest likelihood of success. And so that hopefully we can open it up next year for the fishermen to get in.
Well, does your office have any community meetings planned? I mean, I know, like I said, everybody was so hopeful this summer when they were, moving so fast and removing some of that material from the bay.
No, not just yet. Not until we find out from the engineers what their plans are. Okay? And frankly, I want to wait until to see how much money we've got in the budget, because next week I'm going to have an informational briefing on my Human Services Committee to find out how much in the state budget we can afford to shore up SNAP for an entire state, because there's going to be a cliff coming in. I'm hoping we will likely have a community meeting to see whether or not they have other solutions, because, like I said, the best idea that came out of the biggest community meeting we had on Pohiki actually came from the community, which was the complete dredge. Now it's just getting that money to finish up that complete dredge.
Well, I know the community has been so patient, and like I said, to have their hopes dashed like this, it's just unfortunate.
Super heartbroken.
Yeah, I mean, understandably, the state was looking at a Band-Aid problem, but at least to provide some relief for the fishermen down there.
Yes, no, I completely agree. We'll talk to the community about it as with a presentation from DLNR as to next steps.
Okay, so you're going to be meeting with DLNR then?
Yes.
About what happens now?
Yes.
Anything else that you want to underscore?
No. I mean, frankly, we were hopeful, but the worst case scenario came through, which was basically what the engineers had expected if we only put in a narrow channel dredge, but we had to test it out, and that was the only money allocated in the budget for it.
Right, you did the best with what you had.
Yeah.
That was a very disappointed Senator Joy San Buenaventura, who talked to us this morning about the collapse of the dredging project at the Pohiki boat ramp, which is a lifeline for the Puna community.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, celebrating over 87 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
On the next Science Friday, for the first time, lab-grown salmon is on the menu in a handful of U.S. restaurants. What's the public's appetite for lab fish?
It was bright orange. My first thought was, oh my God, this is Nemo on a plate.
Talking with tastemakers about the future of food. That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Maui Ocean Center, offering island families and individuals memberships providing year-round access to exhibits and educational programs. Learn more about memberships at mauioceancenter.com/membership.
The National Weather Service has issued a red flag warning through Saturday night for leeward sides of the islands. The high winds and drought conditions are a hazard. Today, we focus our attention on Kauai, where new codes are in place for wildfire protection. Overstore Hawaii's Noelle Fujiuride has a story out this week about that. Good morning, Noelle.
Good morning, Catherine. So Kauai has a new Wildland Urban Interface, or WUI, ordinance. And what it does is it aims to reduce wildfire risk specifically in the island's plantation camps through requirements to harden newly constructed homes and better maintain surrounding vegetation. You talked earlier about the warning, right? The high winds and the drought conditions. And these plantation camps, they are located in areas that are more vulnerable to wildfires. And that's essentially because they have a lot of roadside and unmanaged vegetation surrounding them. They're also located in dry areas, and those wind events, dry trade wind or corner wind events, can really spread fires. And so Kauai County really wanted to do was basically build wildfire resiliency into permitting and other approvals for these plantation camps.
And so what kind of improvements are we talking about? Is it cutting back the vegetation? When they say hardening areas, what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, so what it means is that for newly constructed homes, and that includes rebuilds of deteriorating cottages, since many of the homes in these camps are a lot older. So newly constructed homes must have fire-resistant roofs made of metal or asphalt shingle. There's requirements for metal gutters and downspouts, and the gutters actually have to be covered with non-combustible material so that debris can't accumulate in them and then might be an ignition point. The homes also have to have stronger windows and ember-proof fence, as well as ember-proof screen crawl spaces. And then another component is having metal flashing on the exterior walls, and it's at the points where the walls connect to the ground, the deck, and the roof. And the reason why is because embers can linger in those corners and eventually ignite the wood. With wildfires, up to 90% of homes and buildings destroyed by wildfires are caused by windblown embers. So that's really the big danger when it comes to these plantation camps, is that windblown embers can come in from like miles away and damage the homes or destroy the homes.
And we often hear about grasses growing up really high, and some maybe are very close to the structures. But I don't know, when they have landscaping standards, do you have to like put concrete around your house?
Yeah, that's a good question. So for newly constructed homes, the answer is yes. The ordinance talks a lot about defensible space. And so for new constructed homes, they do require a 5-foot concrete band surrounding the home, and that band, you can't have anything on it, right? They don't want anything that could potentially ignite and then spread to the structure. And they also have requirements for all homes to maintain defensible spaces up to 30 and 100 feet away from the structures. So within 30 feet of the structure, you can't have trees larger than 10 feet in diameter, or their canopies can't be larger than 10 feet in diameter. And then within 100 feet of the home, You can't have any fire-prone vegetation taller than 18 inches. So that's things like guinea grass and halicoa, which are fuels for fires.
I'm sure, you know, the other counties like Maui County are probably looking to see what you're doing and see what they can put in place.
Yes, they are right now. They're looking at doing a deep, or they're about to do a deep dive into their built environment codes to look at wildfire resiliency. Kauai County is also doing that. So they're looking at what other spots in our code can we build wildfire resiliency into them. And they're even looking at right now drafting commercial building standards that might be informed by some of the wui for the plantation camps.
Yeah, it's something that we've got to do. I know Hawaiian Homestead Director Kali Watson, he talked about that in some of the areas that weren't burned, that there were fire retardant materials used. So that's just going to be top of mind now with any new construction. But thank you so much, Noelle.
Yeah, thank you, Catherine.
We have been talking to Overstory Hawaii's Noelle Fuji'i Oride. Look for a story on Kauai's new wildfire codes, the first in the state, at overstoryhawaii.org. One of the documentaries that took top honors at the Hawaii International Film Festival last night in the Made in Hawaii category is called Lahaina Rising. It's about the fatal Maui wildfire disaster. And today, Catherine Kluwa-Pachtel joins us with the story about the filmmakers and what it took to make their feature. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
You know, I have to tell you, I was at the award ceremony last night, and that group got the warmest reception from the crowd there. I think just knowing how hard this film was to make.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a big week for this team of filmmakers from Lahaina, the culmination of over 2 years of work for this piece that, you know, for them is really more than just a film. It's the story of their lives and their community and the wildfire, and most importantly, what's come afterward. Lahaina Rising was selected as a feature film documentary at the Hawaii International Film Festival, as you mentioned, with the award ceremony last night. Here's a little taste of what happened at the ceremony. You'll hear the winning announcement, and then I got some reactions from director Maddie Schweitzer afterwards.
This year's Made in Hawaii Award for Best Feature goes to two deserving films. Everyone go, ooh. Tied for first place is Lahaina Rising.
Really hard to explain, really feels surreal right now. I'm grateful, I'm honored, I'm happy, but at the same time, you know, I'm reminded of why we did this project. And, you know, it feels conflicting to be so happy about, again, something that's we wish never happened, but I'm just absolutely honored that my town and my community trusted us to tell this story and that people like it. When they called our name, it was hard to believe, and the crowd just exploded. It was, you know, you could tell that everybody truly, even all the other filmmakers, really honored our project because of what happened and the people in Lahaina. So it was actually really emotional. I'm really excited for our showing November 8th in Maui and bring this award back to the people of Lahaina.
Yeah, it was truly emotional. Just that win for them. Oh, amazing.
Yeah, that's cool that you got to be there. Before I forget to mention, they've had two sold out screenings this week, including their world premiere on Wednesday, and they have actually added a third screening tonight. They were asked to do that third at 6 p.m. at Kahala Theater. So if anyone wants to go see it on Oahu, there's an opportunity tonight. So this core team of generational Lahaina residents and filmmakers was director Maddie Schweitzer, producers DeAndre Makakoa, Blake Ramelb, as well as producer Phil Schleter from Oahu. And I talked with them about why they made the film, you know, the challenges of walking through their own recovery journeys while also working on it, reviewing this footage over and over, and what they really hope people will take away from watching it. Here, Maddie Schweitzer again shares a little bit about that.
Of course, a big part of this film is about the fire, but, you know, I would definitely say a big part of this is we go back in time, showing a little bit about how things were and the synergy that Hawaiians and locals had with the ecology and the environment here. And we kind of really wanted to show people what the potential was, what the potential still is, and a little bit of our disconnect that we've kind of had with the land over the last few hundred years. We go into, you know, the Industrial Revolution with sugarcane and plantation and everything that led up to the conditions that we currently have. And we want to make sure that this film is a lot more than just about a fire. We want to educate people a little bit about how we got to this point, while at the same time, what we feel really is the most important part, which is how strong our community is. How much, you know, regardless of what we went through, we're not going to give up. We're a tight community. And what we did, especially in just a few weeks after the fire, was something I'll never forget. It made me hopeful for humankind to see people coming together, truly giving everything off their back. And I think I'd really just want to make sure that when people finish watching this film, that that's what they take away.
Yeah, I mean, it is a remarkable story.
It is. And the film uses their own footage that they captured along the way. You know, they didn't go into this with the intention of making a documentary, but each of these folks were heavily involved in their community after the wildfires, you know, setting up those community hubs, gathering supplies off the boats that were coming in, you know, really hands-on, boots on the ground, as they still are. And so the film uses kind of their raw footage that they just gathered as they were in that process, uses some of their old footage of Lahaina before the fires, you know, that's hard to come by these days. Also community footage of survivors. They gathered, you know, hundreds of hours of donated footage that folks shared with them, police body cam footage that they obtained, you know, hours and hours of interviews with community members and people, knowledge about the culture and the history and the environment of Lahaina. The team talked about the challenges of going through all of this triggering footage. Blake Rommel, one of the producers, talked about how he still can't watch a section of this film. He shared that, you know, one of his best friend's dad passed away in the fire, and, you know, it's really triggering for all of them. And so they do let people know that, you know, if you think you may have a hard time watching it, you know, make sure you surround yourself by loved ones or some support system. At the screenings, they have trauma-informed counselors available to make sure that everyone is in a safe place while they view it. So there are a lot of Neighbor Island screenings coming up next month. As Maddie shared, there will be one on Maui on November 8th. There's some on Hawaii Island. There's one coming up on Molokai. So you can check the HIF website for the full schedule and the details of how to get those tickets. But there's also a lot coming for the film. It sounds like next year the team has been working on securing a distribution deal with a major streamer, so that's potentially in progress. Impact producer Keely Badger also shared more about what's coming for Lahaina Rising.
Alongside our hope for a distribution deal to get up on a major streamer, we're planning to launch in 2026 a broad-based community education and impact campaign. So a series of screenings, Q&As with the film team and kind of local community leaders and workshops around the film, an all-island screening tour here in Hawaii, and also extending that to mainland North America, particularly fire-affected communities, I think, where this film can really serve as a catalyst for conversation around what community-centered decision-making means, not only in the wake, I think, of fire catastrophe, but kind of the universal message of this film in terms of communities reclaiming land and water resource stewardship and decision-making in preparation for all sorts of climate calamities that folks are facing. So we're really excited to roll out that campaign in 2026 and also really do something beautiful for the three-year anniversary in Lahaina for the community there, and in partnership with some of our community organizations or impact partners that have been doing extraordinary work in Maui.
Yeah, I mean, the recovery is a major deal. But, you know, I do have to mention, you know, last night at that festival, the award ceremony, I overheard a conversation from someone who actually saw the film. And they said, yeah, they were traumatized, you know, coming out because it just, you know, brought back so many feelings. So, yeah, that's something that people really need to be prepared for.
Absolutely. But I think at the end of the day, they really hope that it'll be an inspiration and a hopeful takeaway for folks of what can be done when a community comes together. And also, you know, part of showing that fight for change that's been taking place in Lahaina since the wildfires, what the community is doing to help prevent it in the future, and maybe what other communities can do that view and learn from it as well.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Catherine.
Thanks, Catherine.
We have been hearing from HPR's Maui Nui reporter, Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel. Look for her stories on hawaiipublicradio.org. Time now for another installment of What's in Your Cart. The conversation's D.W. Gibson recently went to Times Supermarket in Aiea. He met Sai from Pearl City, who works in the restaurant business. She talked about making ends meet and balancing a grocery budget for her and her family.
Tell us about what you got today at the market.
A lot of things. I think this is a food good for like 4 to 5 days, I would say, for a family of six.
Okay, that seems pretty well measured. So I'm guessing this is like a really regular trip for you.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, I do have a list before I go in because I don't want to overspend. So everything is pretty much measured. I don't go overshop for, like, you know, excess. So I'd rather buy a little less and then just add something, whatever I have at home, instead of like buying over it.
And so, do you have a dollar amount in your head when you walk into the store of how much you're going to spend?
I do have some estimates, or I have a set budget of like, this is how much I'm going to spend per se. But obviously, sometimes you go over that just because you needed some things.
Are there some items you've noticed that in the last few months have become more expensive?
Oh, for sure. Everything. Just the rice alone, especially eggs. We consume eggs a lot at the house, and those bumped up in price. Butter. Anything that has to do with like poultry and dairy.
Is there one that's tracked that you're tracking that you could give a baseline for? Like, man, I remember a few months ago, I bought a bag of rice for this much and now it's this much.
Yeah, for sure. Like canned foods, I like to stock canned foods just for emergencies on the days that I don't cook. And I keep track on what the prices of like corned beef, Spam, all that kind of stuff, and sausages for my kids. And those went up in price, I don't know, like $5 per box.
Yeah, and those are really important staples to have around. You know, you're feeling the pinch of things getting more expensive. Have you made changes to how you shop, how you think about meal planning?
Oh, of course. I mean, when it comes to like meal planning, you cannot just buy things that you wanted to eat. Sometimes you want to splurge and eat crab or something like that. Obviously, that's going to get cut out from the budget because it's not just, you know, these days you just buy just to survive.
So if you were talking to like local politicians, policymakers, what would you try to tell them in terms of trying to communicate to them the challenges that people have making ends meet in terms of food?
With like the cost of living wise though, like with the prices of everything, I just wish the minimum rate for, you know, hourly rate or salaries are better just so we can get by. And it's kind of like, it will kind of balance this out. Instead of like, you know, you're not earning that much, but you're paying so much for the cost of living. So I think, you know, if anything, it's just people would work regardless. I mean, so I think it will just balances it out if the salary is better, the minimum hourly rate is better.
Yeah, so for you, a conversation about cost of living goes back to the issue of wages and how much we value work. What kind of work do you do?
Oh, I work as an accounts payable office secretary for a restaurant.
Oh, and the restaurant business has had a hard time lately, right?
It is. So we're kind of, you know, doing some stuff at work as well, how to improve our sales, how to cut back on some things that we spend. I work for Gyotaku, Japanese restaurant admin office / Kuromo.
What can you tell us about sort of the cost of food and that in the restaurant environment?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Everything went up. We always get like notices from our vendors that, hey, this is going to go up and stuff like that. So we do have to try to tweak and do some adjustments when it comes to like our inventory for the restaurants. And there's a lot of work that goes into it. Our boss is very involved. The managers of the locations are very involved. All of us are involved.
Oh, that was Sai from Pearl City, Times Supermarket in IAEA. She was talking to HPR's D.W. Gibson. How has the price of your groceries changed? Write to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. As we wrap up our week of highlighting Chinatown, we wanted to explore more of the community's nooks and crannies. By night, Louis Miller and John Holshue take on alter egos. They are the pasta boys at Proof Social Club, serving up fresh homemade noodles. Miller is a co-owner of the bar and actually began the Passion Project about a year ago, now expanding to Italian festivals. The Conversation's Maddie Bender stopped by one night at the beginning of service to talk to the pasta boys about running their pop-up in Chinatown.
Would you mind narrating out loud what you're doing right now?
So right now I am just sheeting out these dough sheets. They're going to be turned into our noodles of the day, which are going to be spaghetti and tagliatelle. We like to portion out all of our sheets beforehand just to make sure, you know, everybody's getting an even portion. We try to get our sheets all kind of prepped up, and that way it kind of ensures a more smooth service. And then when somebody orders some pasta, that's when we actually go and we cut it. We like to try and let the sheet sit out for, you know, 10, 15 minutes. What happens then is it dries out just a little bit on the outside here. And then when we run it through the machine, it kind of creates these really miniature ridges in there, which are going to help hold the sauce a lot better. It's going to create that kind of really savory, super delicious pasta taste that that you can only really get at good Italian restaurants, which we try. What do we have today? We have a tongue and neck ragu, so that's beef tongue and pork neck that is braised slowly at about 300 degrees for 8 hours, and then reduced down again for another 3 or 4. So you're definitely getting a lot of concentrated beef flavor on that one. But then we have a pasta panna e piselli, which is a cream and peas pasta with spaghetti and shallots and garlic, and then topped with a little pecorino romano and parmigiano reggiano.
Do you have a food or food service background? I mean, these sound like complicated dishes to me.
So it's actually like really not that complicated. It's like a lot of pasta dishes and Italian food that's like, you know, generally well known is from cucina povera, which is like, I might be butchering that pronunciation. It's essentially like impoverished kitchen of the poor. So these are all kind of recipes based in not having a lot and trying to make the most out of what little ingredients you might have. So yeah, just trying to follow that philosophy and let the flavors kind of do the talking and not really cover it up too much.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, there's certainly some skill or practice. As you're talking to me, I am watching you knead pasta dough and weigh it to get the gram amount. You can tell that you've done this before.
We've always kind of loved making fresh pasta. John and I have some experience in kitchens. I think John might actually have a little bit more experience than I do, but we always love making pasta. We never really did it at this scale, but you know, there came a time where we weren't really doing any food here at Proof. There was a little bit of a hiatus with the pizza. It wasn't quite working. So John and I decided, hey, why don't we just like do this thing that we really love. I think that we both find pasta like our favorite food. Me for sure.
What's the reception been like?
The community has been like overwhelmingly supportive and positive. It's really actually awesome the amount of support people have been throwing our way. Yeah, we're just like trying to do something different and
really stay true to what we love to eat. Like, John and I have been hanging out in Chinatown for quite some time now. We both kind of like have this idea of the kind of food like we want to eat and think that people deserve to eat. But of course, you know, we're millennials and we're all kind of broke, so it's kind of hard to afford those things. So yeah, trying to provide this kind of elevated experience, or as elevated as we can make it, for our friends and neighbors here in Chinatown.
How do you think of yourself within the context of Chinatown?
Yeah, I think Chinatown is like really conducive to trying new things and experimenting. It's kind of, I think it's the arts hub of Honolulu. So yeah, kind of in that similar vein of just going out there and trying to do something unique that people haven't really tried too much before. Just trying to do something good.
Are there any challenges that you guys face?
Yeah, there's definitely some struggles. I mean, being in Hawaii, it's kind of hard sometimes to source the right ingredients. So there's times where we don't really know 100% what our menu is going to be until we've gone shopping, just because we can't really guarantee that they'll have whatever we need in stock. In the past 2 days, they haven't had the semolina that we usually buy in stock, so we've kind of all been on a mission to find some semolina somewhere at some Safeway. The local Safeway is sold out too, so just like scrambling all day, calling people up like, hey, can you do me a huge favor? But I don't know, I think the challenges kind of make it a little bit more rewarding. There's times where I'm like, man, I wish it would stop being so rewarding and just be a little bit easier, but yeah, it's all part of the game, I think.
Where do you go shopping for stuff usually?
We do a lot of shopping at Chef Zone for kind of more specific stuff. We do a lot of shopping at Costco too. You can't really beat Costco's prices. They got pretty good quality too, honestly. And then I love using Chinatown Market as much as I can. It's just, you know, certain ingredients you can't really find over there. But there is something about Chinatown Market where, I don't know, you feel more connected to the community. There's something about it.
Local supporting local, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's, you know, I can always stop and, you know, stop at Maguro Bros or somewhere else and get some really good food too on the way. So that's always a nice, an added bonus.
Anything else you want to add or you want listeners to know?
Yeah, I'd say like, come down to Chinatown. Come down, support local businesses. There's a lot of people doing like a lot of really cool stuff. Really awesome people down here. Great artists. Just come down and support Chinatown. Don't let Chinatown die and just become another place where people live. There is something really special about this community, and there's a lot of history there, here. So yeah, that's what I have to say about Chinatown.
And John Holshue was in the kitchen fulfilling orders. He spoke about what drew him to this venture.
I had some situations where I realized people were making pasta, but they weren't really making pasta. I wasn't doing anything in my life. And I said, hey, let's do this. And we were just barbecuing at my house, and one day I said, let's do this. We both kind of agreed to it, and a year and 2 months later, here we are.
So really like a be the change you wish to see in the world kind of moment.
Yeah, I used to cook the Big Island, I cooked over here. It's one of the things I've always liked to do, but I wasn't doing it, and we just had the opportunity to do it, so we ran with it.
I mean, what are your hopes, dreams for the next year?
To not work two jobs.
Yeah.
To not work construction in the morning and then this in the afternoon, so we're working on it.
It's tough though, I imagine, of just like, I guess what people term being an entrepreneur, right? Like setting your own hours, there are downsides to that.
I knew that going into it, just because working in the industry for however long I've worked in it. And that's why I kind of went away from that to working a steady job throughout the week and having weekend off. But something that always pulls you back, I think. So there I am again.
Those were the Pasta Boys at Proof Social Club, John Holshue and Louie Miller. You can usually find them on Wednesdays and Thursday nights at the Chaplin Lane Bar from 6 p.m. or until they're sold out. From River Street to Richards, those are the borders of downtown and Chinatown. And an upcoming photography exhibit showcases the life and times between the two halves. On Monday, the mayor signed a bill into law creating a downtown improvement district, but that bill left Chinatown behind. This week, the conversation went live on the road into the heart of Chinatown to talk about its future. We end this week with a look at the Downtown Arts Center, which has a show with powerful pictures of Honolulu that opens on November 6th. Here's Sandy Pohl describing what's in store. She's actually located on Nu'uanu Street at the edge of the downtown bid. But her roots are where she grew up in Chinatown, so she straddles both sides. She starts by explaining that the images in the photography exhibit speak volumes of what was.
It's capturing people's lives here in Chinatown. We're not glitzy here, we're just ordinary. And everybody talks about how the homeless, the dirt, the grit, but they never see the little gems about Chinatown and the real people experiences that is captured in our show. It's an amazing show that particularly chooses different elements of people and the experiences. So this particular show has Kate Kelly, who captured the laymakers during both days in the 30s. And then Francis Haar, who did the Chinatown redevelopment of model cities in the 60s, when they just indiscriminately tore everything down in Chinatown. And so the buildings that are saved were either brick or people just really fought for them so that they could have some semblance of what it used to be like. So the wooden buildings, people rallied, they held marches, just so that they could save those buildings. Because I remember that when I was growing up. And that's what he captured. The photographs in that particular part of the show is fascinating. I saw one on the web about 2 years ago, and I grew up in this neighborhood. So I grew up in Tin Can Alley, which is by Baratania Follies. It was down the hill. It was just really not nasty, but it was just living. It was human living in really crowded situations in wooden buildings. Everybody knew everybody. It was like a real tight neighborhood. And I saw this picture. I was just like skimming it. And suddenly, as I was flipping through it, I got this smell and this taste in my mouth and the human crowdedness that I all of a sudden felt just because I saw this one picture. And I thought, wow, that is amazing that a photograph can bring so much memory back. Because Francis Haar obviously captured something that spoke to me. And that's when I realized how important photography as an art form really is. And so that's why we started this whole thing, is because I want other people to get that same experience. Because when you see the photographs that are in this particular show, that were done for this show, a lot of it is that you get to see the people. You actually can read their emotions and what's going on in the photograph.
It's really authentic, and mm-hmm. It resonates with the people who either grew up here or just frequented this area.
So that's for us as people who lived in the area. But I think for people who just wanted, it gives them a taste of what people are like here today in 2025. Because like there's a couple pictures of people smoking. Well, of course, smoking is so passé, but just the fact that they're all holding different poses, they all look really different, it just captures that feeling of what a good smoke is like. You know?
Satisfaction.
Yeah. I miss that sometimes. I haven't smoked in 40 years, and it's some days I just really miss it. And when I saw that picture, I thought, a really good smoke would be great. But yeah, so that's what this particular show does for me.
It's River to Richard, and we are in the throes of this back and forth over a downtown business improvement district. Chinatown is not included. Maybe at some point it will have its own or somehow be wrapped into the downtown area. But how do you see this exhibit bridging both halves of downtown?
Well, really good question. I think that, so obviously because I run the Downtown Arts Center, I'm really into art. What I've learned over the 5 years that we've been here is that art has real power to change neighborhoods. You can go to any old city and you would see downtown just the way it is. Old town, it doesn't resonate. It's not an attraction. And so a lot of old towns are dying off. And that's what I see about the new Doho, the downtown bid, is that this will rejuvenate the whole neighborhood. We have a lot of artwork from Newmont all the way up to Richard Street. Public art that's just really wonderful. And nobody really notices that. But so that's what I see happening, is that the more attention we pay and using the power of art and community building, that we can actually rejuvenate this into not just any old town, but a place, a sense of place that it was just our neighborhood. Chinatown already has that. They have their regular character system. But what will happen for Chinatown is I think people are going to start taking pride in it, and they're going to start wanting more things that will make the neighborhood, this neighborhood, from Nuwana to River, better place. Because they're going to see that they want more, that they're not going to be complacent about just the same old and just dealing with the problems of every day, that they'll start working together. Because right now, nobody works together. We're all in our little silos. Even at the DAC, even though we talk about community building and collaborating, we're still our own little silos. And then what I remember as a kid was everybody knew everybody. They knew where to go to buy look fun or fish, the best fish, freshest fish. And I see us building a community again, that people know each other, they say hi. It's not like going to any other part of the world or big city or even small town.
Or any other Chinatown.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay, maybe in our Chinatown there are different factions and not everybody agrees on what needs to be done to make it a better Chinatown, mm-hmm. but you feel that maybe this is the opportunity now, since all the attention has gone on the downtown mm-hmm. financial district and mm-hmm. the new investment into downtown, mm-hmm. that Chinatown needs to shine and step up?
Yeah, yeah. And when people start working together, the thing about the downtown bid is that people are going to start working together. They're contributing money. They're contributing energy and resources, talent, that'll make this neighborhood sing. Because they're working together, they're trying to build a community. And we're going to have, in my opinion only, we're going to have the best downtown ever, because we're all working together. We're all doing our little parts to do something that will make the whole neighborhood better. Even if it's just saying hi to another person as you walk down the street, or, hey, have a great day. Those kinds of interactions are really important to make other people feel comfortable and safe, because they know people. It's like you go to the same drugstore and you see the same cashier because you like that person. It's a community that you build. And I see that's what I see for our neighborhood, that's the most important part, that human element. Clean streets, safe streets, really important. That's why the bid is really important, because it brings that resources that will make that happen. But it has to be beyond that. It's got to be more than clean streets. It's got to be that people like each other. They like being in the neighborhood. They go to their favorite coffee shop. They eat at the same place. But when they go to the same place to eat, they're saying hi, they're talking stories, they're mixing with the wait help as well as the owners. Because all of the stores in our neighborhood, from River to Richards, are really mostly small time. They're small, 300 feet, maybe 1,000, maybe 3,000 square feet. They're really small places to do business. So you have to be friendly.
We've got this exhibit. You said it mainly features Chinatown. And if you were to do this again, would it be any different with the downtown bid from Nu'uanu to Richards, right?
Yeah. So the people in Chinatown are more interesting. The shops are more interesting than downtown. That's a given. But people will start coming together. And as we form that sense of place, where people want to come just because they want to hang out in downtown, just like in the old days when I was growing up, it'll have a different character. And of course, then when we do the next photography show, photographers will choose places that are of interest, that are interesting to document. And it's about, not from our point of view as the curator, the installer of the show, but from the photographer's point of view.
So it would be sending fresh eyes out into our downtown.
And because we're focusing so much attention on cleanliness, yeah, there'll be more new businesses, more people coming to shop and eat and play. And so that'll make a really big difference for downtown.
That was Sandy Pohl of the Downtown Arts Center. The gallery is on Nu'uanu, just on the edge there of where the Downtown Business Improvement District ends and Chinatown begins. The photography exhibit, River to Richards, will run from November 6th through the 29th. That is it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we will highlight that second film that tied for the Made in Hawaii Award at the Hawaii International Film Festival and explain its ties to recent headlines. Got some feedback for us? Call and record something at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and the HPR Digital Team. The Backyard Quiz theme, written for us by John DeMello. Our theme music, courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.